Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Conflict, climate change, and disease outbreaks that are behind the high volume of health emergencies around the world have pushed frontline care professionals to the brink of burnout. That's the stark warning from the World Health Organization, WHO, at the start of World Health Worker Week on Monday. After enduring the COVID-19 pandemic, the health workforce is exhausted and in short supply, WHO said. Here's Jim Campbell, Health Workforce Director at WHO.
At the halfway point of the Sustainable Development Goals, after 3 years of the COVID-19 global pandemic, some of the indicators and evidence from countries around the world is alarming. We're seeing, obviously, the mortality of health workers. We're seeing increases of mental health burden amongst our health and care workers. More than one-third exposed to stress and anxiety, and nearly half in some studies reporting burnout.
WHO insists that a reset is needed to boost investment in the global health workforce and scale up healthcare education and jobs. Some 2,000 key stakeholders have gathered at WHO's fifth Global Forum on Human Resources for Health to explore policy solutions to this crisis. As an independent rights probe investigating violations in Libya ends its mandated work this week, the UN Rights Chief on Monday stressed the need to boost justice and rule of law in the country. In a statement, High Commissioner Volker Turk said that Libyan authorities, armed groups, smugglers, and human traffickers should not assume that the eyes of the international community have now left Libya. Accountability for past violations is crucial, the UN Rights Chief said, as he called for continued monitoring in Libya to prevent future violations. In its final report, documenting serious violations by the Libyan authorities and armed groups, some of which may amount to crimes against humanity, the independent fact-finding mission on Libya recommended that the UN Human Rights Office set up a new rights monitoring mechanism for the country. Mr. Turk expressed support for this recommendation and said that his office was committed to working with the Libyan authorities on a human rights plan of action and a victim-centered roadmap on transitional justice and accountability. Staying with human rights, impunity for horrific violations in South Sudan continues as officials implicated in the crimes remain in office, UN-appointed independent rights investigators said on Monday. The latest report of the UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan details widespread attacks against civilians over the past 12 months, including killings, rape, sexual slavery, and other forms of sexual violence, as well as mass displacement. Underscoring the immense suffering of the victims, Commissioner Andrew Clapham said that the state continues to fail in its duty to protect civilians and to ensure accountability for violations. He called upon the authorities to properly investigate alleged perpetrators of serious crimes, no matter their rank or office, and to establish and strengthen the justice mechanisms for holding them accountable. The report names several political and military leaders who it says should be investigated. These include Unity State Governor Joseph Monitwil and Lieutenant General Toy Chanuit in relation to killings carried out in Mayom County in August 2022. The independent experts also called for an investigation into Kok County Commissioner Gordon Kwang for links to attacks against civilians in Lair in February and April 2022. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Good afternoon, listeners. I hope you're having a pleasant day. It is now 81 degrees at 12 o'clock high here in the northeast Kansas area, and it's expected to get up to 85 degrees Fahrenheit by the afternoon. Wind is gusty at a steady, I would say, 10 to 15 miles per hour. It's an incredible contrast. And considering that the computer models have us being at a low of 29 to 30 degrees in less than 24 hours. Try that on for just a size. That's something else, huh? Well, we've got a great lineup today. And as usual, John Grant on our This Can't Be Happening Tuesday second hour slot will be with John Grant. He and I are both anticipating the booking, I don't know, what do you call it, where Donald Trump is going to be indicted. It's a historic day. I consider it sort of a nothing burger, I mean, it's not a significant crime. He's not probably going to be found do any jail time for it. The guy is probably, I mean, it's a high misdemeanor, low felony, if anything. That's what's being speculated in the press. But, of course, see, we've got the Washington Post, the Trump-hater press, with live feeds outside the courthouse in New York City. No noticeable crowds of any kind, protests or anything. And in the second hour of today's show. So I'll tune in and let you know. If you got anything, call in. The second hour is usually open for discussion. The phone number is 646-716-8652. That's the call-in number for the show. If you want to visit with us, go into the green room and visit, push 1. And again, the phone number is 646-716-8652. Now, let's see. Oh, yes, Democracy Now! This is not this morning's headline feed. I had to use what I had, you know? I mean, I could only get it in the time I had. We'll catch up tomorrow. Here's Democracy Now!'s headlines for yesterday morning.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ukraine's military says Russian forces are very far from seizing the eastern town of Bakhmut after Russia's Wagner mercenary group said Sunday it raised the Russian flag over the decimated city's administration building. This followed a weekend of heavy fighting in Bakhmut and other parts of eastern Ukraine. In the nearby town of Kostiantivka, at least 6 people were reported killed from Russian shelling. This is a 69-year-old survivor.
Me and my neighbor ran out to the hallway and we hugged each other very tightly. She's bigger than me and I hugged her very tight and we stood there while everything was shaking because of the explosions. I have no idea we have survived. There were 6 casualties. 6 people just died.
In Russia, authorities say they arrested a woman, Daria Tripova, in connection with a bombing Sunday, which killed the prominent pro-war military blogger Vladlen Tatarsky in St. Petersburg. The Russian ambassador to Belarus said Moscow will station tactical nuclear weapons near Belarus's western border with NATO nations. NATO members will meet this week in Brussels, including Finland, which will officially become the newest member of the military alliance Tuesday. Meanwhile, Russia has assumed the presidency of the UN Security Council for the month in a move blasted by Ukraine as President Volodymyr Zelensky accused the body of bankruptcy. The last time Russia held the rotating presidency was in February of 2022, the month it invaded Ukraine. In Finland, the Prime Minister Sanna Marin has conceded after her center-left Social Democratic Party came in third in Sunday's election behind right-wing nationalist rivals. The National Coalition Party, Finland's main conservative party, won the most votes, though not enough to rule on its own, and will have to form a coalition government. The NCP ran on promises of fixing the economy. A series of severe storms fueled an estimated 11 tornadoes across the southern and midwestern U.S. over the weekend, killing at least 32 people. At least 1 million customers lost power. Homes, businesses, other structures were destroyed or badly damaged in states including Arkansas, Alabama, Indiana, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Iowa. An Arkansas high school teacher surveyed the damage in her classroom Sunday.
I've taught here 25 years, and this is my classroom. And when I walked out yesterday, I didn't realize that would be the last time I would teach in this classroom. We got out at 1:30, which was such a God blessing from our superintendent, because otherwise kids would have been on buses and teachers would have still been here, and so that would have been even more devastating.
More severe weather in the affected regions is forecast this week as scientists in the Biden administration warn such events are worsening in gravity and frequency. In Afghanistan, the Taliban has shut down a woman-run radio station for broadcasting songs and music during the month of Ramadan. Sadia Banawan, which means women's voice in Dari, was the only station led by women founded a decade ago. It's the latest rights attack from the Taliban, as women and girls have also been banned from education beyond the sixth grade and most jobs, with the United Nations warning the growing discrimination and systemic violence may amount to gender persecution, a crime against humanity. Israeli police shot and killed a Palestinian man at the entrance to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Israeli-occupied East Jerusalem Saturday. Witnesses say soldiers fired more than 20 rounds in less than a minute after the man tried to prevent police from harassing a woman who they'd stopped on her way to the mosque. The victim, 26-year-old Mohammed Khaled Al-Asibi, was a Palestinian citizen of Israel who had just finished medical school. In the occupied West Bank, a Palestinian man was fatally shot by an Israeli soldier hours later near the town of Beit Umar. Witnesses say Israeli forces would not let medics access the injured 24-year-old who bled to death. The killings came as the cabinet of Israel's far-right Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it had approved a plan to establish a new National Guard under the control of Itamar Ben-Gvir, Israel's ultra-nationalist national security minister, who once was convicted of racist incitement against Palestinians and supporting a terrorist group. In Syria, state media is reporting that Israeli strikes on Homs province wounded five Syrian soldiers early Sunday. It was at least the ninth airstrike by Israel inside Syria since the start of the year. In Iran, police have arrested a mother and daughter after a viral video showed a man attacking them in a store for not covering their hair in public in the northeastern city of Shandiz. The video shows the man confronting the two women as they wait in line at a shop. The man, who was also apparently later arrested, appears to shout, then pours what appears to be a tub of yogurt over their heads. The women have since been charged with committing a forbidden act and flouting Iran's dress code, which requires women wear a hijab. On Saturday, the Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi reiterated women must always wear the hijab, calling it a religious necessity. The order came even as millions of Iranian women and girls continue to routinely ignore the requirement, especially in Iran's big cities. This is Malika, a 16-year-old in Tehran.
You can't throw a tub of yogurt on a woman's head and think you did something great and to guide someone in the right direction. It's that person's business. She wanted to dress like that, and she dressed however she wanted. It's no one's business.
Twitter's billionaire owner Elon Musk has ordered the social media platform to remove a badge showing verified status for the New York Times after the paper's editors refused to pay for its Twitter Blue service. This comes after Twitter instituted a pay-for-play system in which companies, nonprofits, and government institutions have to pay $1,000 a month to keep check marks showing their accounts have been verified. So far, only a few dozen accounts have seen their badges removed. Musk signaled he'd remove the Times checkmark over its coverage, which he blasted in a tweet as propaganda. Other prominent accounts, reportedly including those of White House staffers, have refused to pay for Twitter Blue. That's led to fears over misinformation and hate speech by imposter accounts on Twitter ahead of the 2024 presidential elections. Donald Trump's 2024 presidential campaign raised over $4 million in 24 hours following the news last week of his indictment by a Manhattan grand jury connected to a 2016 hush money scheme. Trump released a fundraising video Sunday, 2 days before his expected arraignment in New York.
The election was rigged and stolen, but now we're going to take back our country in 2024. If you're doing well because all of the things that I've done have brought you wealth and prosperity, or at least you're extremely comfortable, it would be really great if you could contribute to our campaign.
Trump is expected to speak from Mar-a-Lago Tuesday evening following his arraignment. Invitations have already gone out. Over the weekend, Trump lashed out against New York Supreme Court Justice Juan Merchan, who's overseeing his criminal case, claiming he, quote, hates me. It's the same judge who presided over the prosecution of the Trump Organization and CFO Alan Weisselberg. Meanwhile, former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson announced Sunday he'll run for the Republican presidential nomination. Hutchinson called on Trump to withdraw from the race due to his legal troubles. As Governor, Hutchinson signed a trigger law banning abortion in 2019 and made Arkansas the first state to impose work requirements for Medicaid recipients, costing over 18,000 people to access the program before a court blocked the requirement. Millions of U.S. residents are poised to lose Medicaid health insurance as protections put in place at the start of COVID-19 pandemic begin to lapse. Under a bipartisan deal reached by Congress late last year, states are allowed to remove Medicaid recipients from the rolls as early as April 1st unless they prove they still qualify. Some residents of five states, Arizona, Arkansas, Idaho, New Hampshire, and South Dakota, have already been kicked off Medicaid. Part of what the Biden administration estimates will ultimately be 15 million people losing benefits, including millions of children. The FDA has approved the opioid overdose drug Narcan to be sold over the counter. Narcan, a quick-acting naloxone nasal spray, could become available in pharmacies as well as convenience stores and gas stations by late summer. Opioid overdoses killed over 81,000 people in 2021. It's not yet known how much manufacturer Emergent BioSolutions will charge for Narcan. Advocates are calling for the life-saving drug to be distributed for free. Democratic Senator John Fetterman of Pennsylvania has checked out of Walter Reed Hospital after receiving inpatient treatment for depression since mid-February. Fetterman is scheduled to return to the Senate April 17th after the two-week holiday recess. In a statement, Senator Fetterman urged others with mental health challenges to seek help. He spoke candidly about his depression during an interview on CBS's Sunday Morning.
It's like you just won the biggest, you know, race in the country. And the whole thing about depression is that objectively you may have won, but the depression can absolutely convince you that you actually lost. And that's exactly what happened. And that was the start of a downward spiral.
Senator Fetterman had a stroke while he was running for the Senate against Mehmet Oz, but still won. California will require half of all heavy trucks sold by 2035 to be electric as it moves to phase out diesel trucks. The Environmental Protection Agency on Friday granted waivers for California to set its own truck pollution standards that are stricter than federal ones. Last year, California passed a measure requiring all new passenger vehicles sold to be fully electric by 2035. Transportation accounts for some 40% of California's greenhouse gas emissions. Supporters of political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal are raising alarm after a judge on Friday denied his request for a new trial. Philadelphia Judge Lucretia Clemens dismissed evidence the case was tainted by judicial bias, police, and prosecutorial misconduct, and that key witnesses were bribed or coerced. Mumia Abu-Jamal is 68 years old. He suffers from numerous health problems. The journalist and former Black Panther has maintained his innocence for the four decades he's been in prison after being convicted of murdering a police officer. A federal court blocked Tennessee's highly contested law targeting drag performance on Friday, just hours before it would have gone into effect. The temporary injunction came in response to a lawsuit filed by LGBTQ group Friends of Georgia's, which argued the legislation is overly broad and violates the First Amendment. The measure is the second major legislative attack on the trans community in Tennessee. The state also banned gender-affirming health care for trans youth last month. And queer and trans youth-led actions across the United States Friday, marking International Transgender Day of Visibility and amid intensifying discrimination, violence, and anti-trans laws pushed by Republicans. Here in New York, hundreds took to the streets in a march organized by NYC Youth for Trans Rights. Democracy Now! Producers Tamari Astudio and Maria Tarasena were there and spoke to 17-year-old Raven.
It is so amazing to look around and see people like me that have had the same experiences as me, who know what it's like to be trans. And it's so great to just, you know, watch everybody be happy and be themselves in a safe place. I'm the happiest I've been in a really, really long time here in this space with these people. And I think that it's so good for people who think that they're alone to know that they have people out there, people fighting for them, people fighting with them, people on their side. Because, like, a lot of them just don't have that. They go through so much. And the gathering around, being able to look at people and hug people and talk to people that are like them is something that can really heal a heart.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
That's right. And if you want it, you can get it every morning at 7 o'clock Central at democracynow.org, or you can watch it on channel here in Northeast Kansas, at least. You can watch it live at 7 a.m. at channel 19.2, the local PBS affiliate out of Kansas City. KTPS? KPST, I never can remember the call letters, 19.2 over-the-air antenna. And now coming up is Counterspin, and it runs about 28 minutes, and I'll be back with you, and we'll work on getting John Grant on the telephone for the second hour.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, there are a number of issues or realities where good-hearted people are overwhelmed and frankly misled about how isolated they are in their view and what levers of power they may have to pull on. We can live in a better world, and we should interrogate those who say, oh, no, we're smarter people, and we're here to say you just can't. One of those stories is migration or immigration, or to be real, do black and brown people have a right to move freely in the world? If not, why not? Another issue is healthcare. Do we really need to be making choices between seniors getting needed health care and other people getting needed health care? Do we need to run our health care system on for-profit incentivizing? Is there genuinely no other way? These are big conversations that have to happen outside and without corporate news media, who are literally invested in particular responses and not others. So we're going to get some ideas of where to start this week with Silky Shaw, Executive Director at Detention Watch Project, about the Ciudad Juarez fire and what it tells us about immigration policy. And also with Egan Kemp, healthcare policy advocate at Public Citizen, about the fight around Medicare and Medicare Advantage and where that places us in a conversation about healthcare rights and responsibilities. Conversations that cry for bigger and deeper conversations. This week on Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. While it was a nightmare, the March 27th fire at a migrant detention center in Ciudad Juarez that killed at least 40 people and injured dozens more is inappropriately labeled an accident. Not when it's more an illustration of systemic harms that reflect inhumane policy. Silke Shaw is Executive Director at Detention Watch Project. She joins us now by phone from Washington State. Welcome to Counterspin, Silke Shaw.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, the hundreds of people protesting and, frankly, grieving outside of the Ciudad Juarez Detention Center on Tuesday night, the 28th, they weren't calling for better fire protections or less overcrowding. The chant that the group took up was Justicia. It isn't that they aren't connected, but these are fundamentally different conversations to have, right, about justice or about better conditions.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things when you're watching the video of the fire taking place and the guards leaving as men are locked up in the cells at the migrant detention center in Juarez, it reminded me a lot of what happened during Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans so many years ago, when actually guards just left people locked up in cells as water rose. And this is what we know about the prison system in the U.S., the jail system in the U.S., and a lot of what the U.S. is doing, which is outsourcing immigrant detention to Mexico. And this has been, especially since the Trump administration, the number of people locked up in migrant detention centers, which they called immigration stations, in Mexico has risen dramatically.
Well, I saw the NBCNews.com headline, "Advocates decry inhumane conditions of Mexico's migrant detention centers after deadly fire." That was the headline. And I might sound pedantic, but words mean things. And so this headline tells me that conditions are the problem, right? That it's a Mexican problem, and that it's only advocates, whoever they are, that are mad. And maybe they weren't even mad until the fire, you know? So, like, there's a lot of storytelling happening here. And I just wonder what you make of the way media talk about the fire and the way that that fits into this bigger narrative.
I mean, one of the things about the way immigrant detention is covered, both in the U.S. and now more so in Mexico as the numbers have risen, is it's an assumption that detention should exist, that people should be detained just because they are on the move, because they're trying to, for most of the men who are in these, I mean, for all the men who are in these prisons in migrant detention centers in Mexico, they are seeking safety. They are fleeing situations. Most of them were Guatemalan, and they were trying to get into the U.S. And so what's happening in that headline is a story that, well, there's this people who are migrating need to be detained, an assumption already being made about that. The problem is the conditions and not actually anything else, which is not offering legal pathways, creating more militarization at the border, pushing for deterrence, everything that the U.S. government has been doing for many, many years and became even that much more heightened since 9/11 and also under the Trump administration. But the truth is the Biden administration has continued Trump-era policies that have only exacerbated these conditions. So more people are stuck in these towns at the border, and the shelters don't have availability. People are on the streets, and then they're pushing them to put them in these quote-unquote migration stations. And these are the conditions that end up taking place. You know, and again, people don't want to be deported, and they protest inside these situations while people are incarcerated is quite typical. And instead, what happened here now is that the Mexican government is putting blame on the guards, which should get blamed, but also what are the conditions that were created where you now have men stuck in these facilities when the fire is happening and people passing the buck in terms of who's responsible?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the conversation needs like a paradigm shift. Narrative is so important. Storytelling is so important in the way that U.S. media present immigration. And you've written about this and spoken about this, about the idea of there's good immigrants and there's bad immigrants. And it's narrative plays such an important role. But one of the important things that it does is to say some people, just by virtue of trying to move from one country to another, are criminals and should be treated as criminals. And that framing really instructs news media in terms of how they tell folks about what's happening.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's such a, you know, the U.S. has the large, you know, it's the quote-unquote nation of immigrants, but the U.S. incarcerates more immigrants than anywhere else in the world. And you can't deny that relationship to mass incarceration in the U.S. because, again, the U.S. is one of the leading incarcerators in the world. And we have a massive prison and jail system. And the narrative around, and even now in the sort of backlash to the uprisings in 2020 and tough on crime narratives, and so much of that is placed on immigrants. Now immigrants are quote unquote committing crime, and the act of, you know, being in the U.S. without documentation isn't technically a crime, but crossing the border is, if you get caught or not prosecuted, you are convicted of a crime and could spend anywhere from 30 days, 6 months to 2 years in prison for that. And a lot of it is the narrative, and it's also ignorance about the political economy that's created around these systems as well. And we see that at the border as well in terms of militarization. Who are the contractors? Who are the people who are making money off of more border militarization, off of more prisons being at the border? And the U.S. really, again, the Biden administration has completely followed Trump's path in creating these conditions, pushing more militarization, pushing for these policies that make the conditions on the Mexican side of the border that much worse.
Well, I want to actually pull this to a different point because I feel like media segregate a lot of issues, and border issues are one thing, but then there's a whole separate section of the paper that talks about the global economy, right? And that's a whole other thing. So corporate media will report every day with a straight face how Walmart or whatever, oh, just naturally they're getting their labor in Bangladesh, and just naturally they're stashing their profits offshore, you know, to skip out on U.S. taxes. Because, you know, transnational corporations do what they got to do. And the idea that capital need observe no borders but humans,
right,
or, you know, labor, should actually die trying to cross them, you know, I mean, that's a square peg in a round hole, even at the level of so-called economic theory. But this kind of discordant, lopsided vision holds sway in news media as if it were economic dogma.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, NAFTA is the perfect example mm-hmm. of what you're talking about, where now borders were open for capital, borders were open for companies, borders were open for trade. But people, like, that was also the moment that the Clinton administration put in a prevention through deterrence approach to the border, which made it that much more difficult for people to come. And many people who came, I mean, one of the things that sort of happened is immigration in the minds of the U.S. media is a question of crime and safety, when in fact it's really a question of labor migration and family relationships. And so instead, all of these tough on crime, war on drugs, I mean, of course, now the border is the site of the fentanyl crisis, when in fact the opioid crisis is really a public health question. And so these are the kinds of narratives that are put forth, and it really prevents, again, the idea capitalism is fine, but the conditions that the U.S. has created because of U.S.-backed wars in other parts of the world, U.S. empire, and also globalization, are not things we're supposed to actually consider when we're looking, and climate catastrophe for that matter, are not things we're supposed to consider when they're putting in these policies at the border.
And, you know, we'll take this up in the future, but I do want to tell folks that activists and advocates and workers are already doing international work, are already doing cross-border work. You know, we recognize that workers are workers wherever they are. People are people wherever they are. It's just that that work is not necessarily, that transnational work is not necessarily acknowledged by news media, and so people might not be aware that it's happening, but it's happening.
Absolutely. And, you know, especially at the border, this is where it's happening. And I think many communities are in conversation with each other trying to figure out how to support migrants really struggling. I mean, it's a really challenging situation. And there is a lot of opportunity to figure this out. And again, as the Mexican government has grown its detention system, there's also the International Detention Coalition that has offices in Mexico City and has also been working on this, and we've been in communication with them. And it, in so many ways, our ability to sort of address these issues, it can't just be this insular U.S. focus. It really needs to be a global conversation to prevent future deaths.
We've been speaking with Silke Shaw, Executive Director at Detention Watch Network. They're online right where you'd look at detentionwatchnetwork.org. Silke Shaw, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
You may have seen television ads warning ominously of D.C. liberals breaking promises to seniors with proposed cuts to Medicare Advantage and calling on local legislators to fight back. You might wonder why a multi-million dollar scare campaign would be the first recourse of a deep-pocketed industry that was genuinely concerned with senior citizens' health care and well-being. But the health insurance system in the United States is nothing if not confusing. And as with any situation created and sustained by human actions, you're right to wonder, is this the best we can do? How can we do better? Or more pointedly, why can't we do better when we know we have a population that needs health care and a country that can afford it? News media could play an informing and an explaining role here, but that's not what seems to happen. Egan Kemp is healthcare policy advocate at Public Citizen. He joins us now by phone from Salt Lake City. Welcome to Counterspin, Egan Kemp.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I'm going to ask you multiple things, and we can't do justice in the time we have, but I do want to ask you just to orient us a bit, because right now we're kind of in the midst of competing claims. The proposed changes to Medicare Advantage are either going to take needed medicine away from seniors, or they're about combating fraud and overbilling. Understanding that we're not talking about a perfect response to a perfectly defined problem, what are we kind of looking at right now with Medicare Advantage and the Biden proposals on changes? What's a useful way to understand that?
Yeah, it's really a crucial time for Medicare Advantage and for the Medicare program more generally. I think the reason that you're seeing these ads, you know, trying to scare people into getting their legislator to protect Medicare Advantage is that a lot of Medicare Advantage insurers have been caught with their hand in the cookie jar. Just to step back briefly, you know, traditional Medicare, you know, has been around for a long time and has served, you know, millions of Americans, hundreds of millions of Americans. But the Medicare Advantage plan is more recent and just around in the past couple decades, but it's been growing quickly. And the Medicare Advantage plan, sort of the big difference there is they're able to profit off the health care for seniors, whereas traditional Medicare is nonprofit. It serves seniors, you know, where they are in terms of what they need. And as Medicare Advantage has grown, it's become more profitable, and these companies have gotten better at sort of taking advantage of seniors, and now they've been caught. And so there's been more research highlighting areas where seniors have struggled to get the care they need, how much extra it costs the U.S. in terms of if you just covered those seniors through traditional Medicare. And so they really are trying to defend their profits at a time when they can see the Biden administration and Congress really put them in the crosshairs and beginning to make steps to hold them more accountable for their actions.
So who's behind this current information campaign, and what are their goals here?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the biggest player is what we refer to as AHIP, or America's Health Insurance Plans, which really is sort of a cabal of all the biggest insurers that put money in and then use AHIP as cover for lobbying and direct political influence, sort of glad-handing with politicians and to the extent possible with the White House. And so they are always going to work on behalf of insurers' ability to profit, regardless of what that means for seniors. And so they're seeing the losses that, you know, pharma has had recently when it comes to things like insulin, when it comes to things like negotiating the cost of some drugs with Medicare. And insurers are scared too. They see that they're sort of next on the chopping block because they've had it so good for so long, and Medicare Advantage has never delivered on the promise of actually lowering the cost of care or improving the quality of care.
Well, let me ask you how that fits with the Washington Post editorial I saw, I guess, a couple weeks ago. A fiscally responsible government cannot keep its hands off Medicare. I was trying to sort of mentally separate Medicare and Medicare Advantage. I see you connecting them, and I see now the Washington Post saying, we just got to get into those funds. Like, what's the connection there?
Yeah, it's a really important connection, and I think it's one of the more challenging ones, because I think one of the things that the Medicare Advantage plans and sort of the private insurers that profit off this do well is conflating the two, conflating Medicare Advantage and traditional Medicare. And the real issue is that traditional Medicare has always cost less. It's always served seniors more consistently, but it doesn't place ads. It doesn't fill the airwaves the way that Medicare Advantage plans do when someone's turning 65. These Medicare Advantage plans do a lot of often misleading advertising so that they can, what we refer to as cherry pick, the healthiest seniors, and then lemon drop sicker seniors and make sure that they stay in traditional Medicare. Mm-hmm. And it's something that Medicare Advantage plans have gotten better at. And the more people that are in Medicare Advantage, the more it's a threat to the long-term health of the entire Medicare program. Right now, we're close to 50% of seniors on Medicare Advantage, and we know that it would cost a lot less to cover those seniors in traditional Medicare. And so it is existential for the Medicare program, and it's something that in the short term, you know, the Biden administration and Congress really need to crack down on bad actors in Medicare Advantage. But in the long term, you know, moving towards a system that both improves and expands traditional Medicare while at least putting Medicare Advantage on a level playing field. But in the long term, it's just unclear that there's any positive role for Medicare Advantage.
Well, let me ask you, because I wanted to give you an opportunity to connect this and to talk about a new report that Public Citizen has done, but I know listeners will understand who are regular media consumers. For elite media, if anything is a public-private partnership, well, then that is the holy grail. That is exactly what we want, because heaven forbid anything be wholly public or publicly supported, and so public-private is kind of, you know, that's the exemplar, just narratively, is my feeling from elite media. And I know that you've just released a new report on the role of private equity in healthcare. The role, maybe, is too gentle of a phrase. The report is called Private Equity's Path of Destruction in Healthcare Continues to Spread. So let me just ask you to break down a little bit for listeners. What is the problem that you're mapping here, and how does it connect with these broader healthcare issues?
Yeah, I think it really connects sort of at the nexus of profit. So private equity companies are generally sort of large, privately held. They don't have a lot of accountability or transparency. Many of them, if you knew their name and then you tried to search them on Google or somewhere else, you would not be able to find an ounce of information. They're very secretive. They hold their secrets and investments close. Some of the bigger ones you might be able to find a bit about. But they are shady actors, and their primary drive is profit above all else. And in healthcare, that's particularly scary because they also move much more quickly than even sort of traditional healthcare actors. I mean, to me, they're sort of even scarier in terms of their actions than, you know, traditional insurers that are also focused on profit, mm-hmm. but do have a longer sort of timeline that they plan to have in the industry. If you're a private equity company, you want to buy in and you want to get out within 3 to 5 years, and you want to pull as much as you can in terms of profit out. So it means really taking underhanded tactics like selling a hospital out from under the hospital administration. So you might buy this entire healthcare system. You sell that hospital immediately, sort of cash that check, and now you're charging that hospital that you just bought a very expensive lease. If this is not a sort of a high-margin hospital, or if it's in a rural area or an urban area, it may have a really difficult time staying in business, but as a private equity company, you don't care because you're about to sell that or you're about to flip it to somebody else and you're going to move on. And that real sort of dedication to profit across the healthcare industry, and that's really what we go into the report, over nearly 15 different areas where private equity has engaged recently in the healthcare system and sort of scary places like where they're going next, such as, you know, hospice or end-of-life care.
Well, I'm just going to ask you finally and briefly, and we'll clearly talk much more in the future, but we know that policy is shaped by people's understanding of what is possible, and we know that news media shape that understanding. So for me, corporate news media are chock-a-block with what they would call news you can use, like, can I apply for disability while on Medicaid? Does it make sense to divorce my spouse so that we could see if maybe I could maybe get my meds covered? You know, it's reporting that assumes that you're over a barrel and that masses of us are over a barrel, but is somehow too timid to say this is crazy and cruel and unnecessary and to talk about systemic change. And if anybody does, well, then they're a freak and they're actually a problem that needs to be contained. And so knowing that you can't say all you'd want to say, what are your thoughts about media coverage of this issue?
Yeah, it is a challenging area. I think that some of the real bad actors in both private equity and in big pharma, Medicare Advantage, and sort of other insurers, I think there is starting to be a bit of a different tone. I think Americans are having enough pain points and sort of talking about them or coming together to push for things like Medicare for All. I think that's why, you know, during the 2016, the 2020, presidential debates, there was just so much angst and frustration around the healthcare system and sort of real support for things like Medicare for All. And the sort of corporate media is certainly not there yet, but I think there enough stuff is starting to break through that they can't just ignore it. And so you are starting to see, you know, even New York Times or the Washington Post really cover in more detail some of the fears around prescription drugs or around Medicare Advantage or some of the abuses that we're seeing even during COVID-19 by insurers and others. And it's an important time for folks to also tell their stories and to also get engaged because they want to demoralize us, or the industries want us to stay demoralized and separated. But it's when we come together that we can really push for the change that we need.
I'm going to end on that note. We've been speaking with Egan Kemp. He's health policy advocate at Public Citizen. You can find their work, including this new report on private equity and healthcare, online at citizen.org. Thank you so much, Egan Kemp, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to learn about FAIR's newsletter Extra and to show support for the show if you are able and so inclined. Counterspin is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Thank you.
Well, listeners, we got John Grant on the phone. Had a little difficulty. You've been listening to the soundtrack. Well, it's a medley soundtrack from the movie 1980s. This is an 80 eco thriller, 1985, called Edge of Darkness. It had won 6 BAFTAs. It's produced by the BBC. Edge of Darkness. It's very difficult to get it, but it is available on parts of it are available on YouTube. I wanted to play that to you because it's one of my favorite 6-part television movies put out by BBC. And it seemed to be appropriate, Edge of Darkness. I mean, you know, here we go with John Grant. John, are you there?
I'm here. I've got MSNBC on here. I can go to Fox News. Apparently, Trump is in the building. He's in the criminal courtroom building. And he has a 2:15 appointment before the judge. Here comes the judge.
Well, Eric Trump, his son, guesstimated, and I'm sure it's inaccurate, but it's that New York City is spending $200 million to secure today.
I think Eric, as usual, has his head so far up his ass that he doesn't. That's a little outrageous. I'm sure they certainly spent at least $1 million on this. I mean, I mean, you know, this Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, the whack job from Georgia, said she was coming up here to stir things up. And, you know, the mayor yesterday, Mayor Adams, you know, a tough black cop, said, hey, baby, and mentioned her literally by name. And he said, hey, you know, come on to New York. Welcome to New York, but we don't want any trouble. And if you have any trouble, we're going to take care of you, Ms. Taylor Green, you know, and she was said, oh my God, the mayor of New York threatened me. It's unbelievable, she said, you know. Well, that's the way it is. This isn't backwoods lynch country Georgia, honey, you know.
Yeah.
This is New York City, the Big Apple, you know. This is the big town that spawned Donald Trump, and they're done with him. They're going to throw him down.
Well, the rumors are, and he has to come out. It's amazing the networks are. Even in Kansas, especially here, Fox News is has an alert out and an alert that's live from the criminal court there in Manhattan, and it's just showing a bunch of bored cops what the camera view is with empty-headed talking faces. On the right, you know, going on, let's see, for Andy McCarthy, former U.S. attorney, assistant U.S. attorney's bloviating right now. But, you know, it really is a much ado about, I mean, it's sort of, I'm surprised that they've even, doing this. You know, frankly, I think they could have sent the papers to, it's 30 counts. Rumors, 30-plus counts. I mean, it's like taking 30 hits off of a joint and getting caught off each time. I mean,
well, we don't know. They say some of them may just be repetitive. In other words, he did the same thing 30 times, and that's, you know, they just pile them up. But the point is, you know, they're like the governor of DeSantis in Florida jacking around. He's a lawyer, you know, and all this, the JAG lawyer. And he's saying, well, this is a misdemeanor that they're pumping up to a felony. Well, that's true. That's in the law. I'm sorry, pal, but the law says that if you do this crime for a certain reason, it's a felony, and that's what he did. And they have the goods on him every which way from north, south, east, and west. And, you know, they already put his lawyer in jail for the same exact crime and said he was guilty of it. So, you know, he doesn't have much of a leg to stand on here. He's in an enemy camp. You know, Margaret Taylor Greene has established civil war, that we are going to separate American states, red states and blue states. She already advocated that. And now she expects to come to the capital of the blue states and, you know, protest. They are not going to live up to that. They're not going to accept that at all. And so to me, this is one of the great spectacles of our age. I don't know if anybody has read Guy Debord, you know, spelled Guy Debord, a French intellectual radical in the 1960s, 67, wrote the theory of the spectacle, which is now, with the Internet, become more true than ever. And Donald Trump knows this instinctually. Well, unfortunately for Donald Trump, the spectacle is shifting flavors here, if you will. And this, here comes Bragg. He's walking in, the DA. This spectacle, this is the beginning of the spectacle of Donald Trump's downfall. You heard it here first. This is it. This is the crack. This is the first crack. My wife and I used to think Donald was going down like Jimmy Cagney in White Heat, you know, top of the world, Ma, top of the world. Instead, I think he's going down, he'll be like Wile E. Coyote, just over the cliff, and he'll realize he's overextended, and all of a sudden he'll say, oh, shit, and drop like a rock, and there'll be a little poof down at the bottom of the canyon. And it's beginning right now. Well, anyway, that's my theory. That's my theory.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, beep, beep, you know, to imitate the...
beep, beep, right.
The road runner, you know, I mean yeah, I think I saw a road runner running in front of his motorcade. This morning I was, you know, I just left the TV on and I thought of that.
Right.
That analogy that you used, because I thought, well, is there a road runner in front of the motorcade leaving Florida, you know, as he's going to Florida.
Right.
Or maybe it's when he came off.
Well, he had a motorcade on each end, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and I noticed the TV, the networks are following this. I think it's really, the best thing they could do is not pay attention to this, but
they can't help it. Hey, they can't help it, and Trump knows that. He understands that we live in the age of the spectacle. You know, this is a society that's broken down, especially with the Internet and through social media. The spectacle is it. And so the news media are going to cover this. There's no question. And they've made so many analogies with O.J. Simpson's white Bronco run, you know, and it's like... it's very different, obviously, but it's the same wacky spectacle. They can't get enough cameras on it. There's cops everywhere here, you know. This is the biggest spectacle of the moment. And as I say, this is the one where it's going to change course, where, you know, it used to be Donald Trump had this guard all shield or whatever, and he was, you could shoot a guy on Fifth Avenue and get away. Well, no more. The country, especially the blue states like New York City, the Big Apple, are fed up with their own favorite son, Donald Trump. They're done with him, and they're going to put them down here. And there's three other cases that are coming. They're even more important than this one. And he's going to be so much trouble for the Republicans. Eventually, they're going to say, hey, this guy's done. Poof. He's going to be a little poof at the bottom of the canyon. And they'll move on. You know, they'll move on with Ron DeSantis and other slobs, you know, and there we go, you know.
Well, I stand. I'm on CBS now. Same coverage, same camera angle, same camera angle.
Right.
A live camera angle inside the hallway of the criminal court.
Right.
It says outside arraignment courtroom. Except on
right.
CBS.
There's all, yeah.
CBS
yeah.
has women. Let's see, Ricky Kleeman, legal expert for CBS. She's talking head on the left.
Right.
Of course.
Right.
Fox
okay.
News is on the right, and it has, I mean, it's such a comedy, I think.
It is a comedy. You have to look at it as a comedy.
It's completely empty. It's like these people, the hallway's completely empty, except for a bunch of cops overweight cops.
Right.
With that, except for one.
Well, there's a lot of
female.
Overweight cops. That's what I'm looking at. A lot of overweight
yeah.
cops just standing around here.
Right.
These guys need to work out a little bit. You know, it's like.
Yeah. Right. It's sort of. Sad.
You know, but you get about six or eight of them on you. You don't have a chance. You know, it's like
no,
I've
yeah,
seen
yeah,
that
you
know. In Philly. You know, where they six or seven fat cops will jump somebody, but. You know, that's just
they'll
their
squeeze,
nature.
Squeeze the air right. They'll squeeze the air out right out of you. I can't breathe. You're right.
Right, exactly.
Goddamn. There's got to be eight of you
but,
bitches laying on top of me. You know, you have,
right,
I mean,
yeah.
they're killing. They're killers. They're real killers. They don't even need guns.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, you say this is an absurdity. I think it's totally absurd, and it's a comedy, except inside Judge Mershom's court, it
yeah,
is not going
right,
to be
right.
a comedy.
Well,
he's
going
to go. He's going to go by the rules, and you know he'll warn the guy at first, and you know no more mouthing off outside. I don't you know call me a shitbag outside. I don't like that. Stop doing that. And you know we're going to have your trial here, and whenever it'll probably be a year from now. It'll probably be in the midst of the next campaign for president. But hey, this is the way it works.
Well, the it's a low felony. It's small time
yeah.
bananas.
Right.
They've turned
right.
it. I mean, this is like the equivalent of, I don't know, in New York with their legalized marijuana. It'd be like getting busted with a quarter pound of weed, you know, walking down Fifth
yeah,
Avenue
right.
instead of a gun. Yeah, it's sort of weird that the nation is here's CBS covering it live. Fox
right.
News live,
right.
and I haven't went to ABC
right.
yet, but I'm just saying, and it's the same camera
yeah.
angle.
Well,
they
let one guy in with a camera. Yeah.
Overnight, they
mm-hmm.
the judge threw out the live camera feed into the courtroom and
yeah.
limited it to, I guess, five photographers. Fox
well,
News,
before the, he gavels it in, I guess he's letting photographers come in the jury box and photograph the you know the courtroom with all the people in it, and then they run them out, and they're going to have no cameras in there during the
uh-huh.
business.
Uh-huh.
And this is only an arraignment; it's going to take like 10 minutes.
Right.
You know, I mean,
right.
you've been to
yeah.
these things yourself. I've been to them. You're waiting
oh, yeah.
for something to happen. You realize, fuck, it already happened. You know, they're up there,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
whispering to each other and hitting the gavel, and it's done. You know,
yeah.
they've already set up their ducks before. You know.
Yeah, I used to take guys in and take their handcuffs off of them, and we'd go and sit and get bored to death and watch the
uh-huh.
orange suit. There'd be. For my guy, and we'd have to watch all the guys in the orange overalls from the jail,
jumpsuits,
county jail.
Right, of course.
They have to get through their stuff too before. So it's boring, and it's really there's nothing to it except maybe my guy will get a bail set, which is what my job
right.
was is to get his bail set. So I mean, I hate to sound like Donnie, but it's a nothing
uh-huh.
burger. It really is.
Well,
that's bullshit
because it's not a nothing burger, Mike, because here you got the former president of the United States who says, you know, you can kill a guy on Fifth Avenue and get away with it, and now he's the ex-president, and, hey, I'm untouchable, you can't touch me. Well, so what? It's a parking ticket. I don't give a shit. The point is they're going to nail him with it, and they're going to prove one very important thing. Donald Trump is not above the law. He's culpable
well,
in the face of the law. And this is only the first of four cases, and this is the most insignificant of the bunch. But it's the first one, as somebody pointed out. This was done right on the cusp of the election in order that in the last 2 weeks people wouldn't know that he was, you know, had a deal with Stormy Daniels, you know, and was going to his character and all that. This was after the, you know, the grab the pussy thing he said. So, you know, he didn't want that publicized. So the point was very concerted, willful effort to prevent this from getting into the mind of the electorate. Who should know this stuff, you know? And You know, so they're it's making chronologically, this would be the first of all these other cases, because the other cases are involved once he becomes the president of the United States. In this case, it was a desperate effort to prevent information that would have probably, you know, we would now have Hillary Clinton as president then. But anyway, so that's the argument. That's why this case is so important, you know, because it's the first chronologically of all the four cases. And, you know, who knows, you know, when the other ones are going to drop. Apparently, the Georgia grand jury has just till the end of April, so they're figuring, you know, this is going to, that case is going to drop, you know, middle to end of April. Mm-hmm. And then you got the two Washington cases with this real ace prosecutor who doesn't take any nonsense from anybody, who's, you know, got the one on January 6th and the
Mar-a-Lago
secret,
raid.
Yeah, the secret stuff, yeah. So he's got his plate full, you know. And
well, yeah,
the fact that
it will be full.
I think the nation and the legal system is not paying the attention they used to pay to the political elections. In other words, it takes so long to start a trial. If you said, well, we can't have it during an election campaign, we have election campaigns all the time now. They start 2-3 years before the election. So that's no longer a restriction. We're going to have a criminal trial, maybe even four criminal trials during the next presidential election. I mean, imagine that. Talk about a spectacle, for God's sakes. You know, this kind of radical idea of, you know, that the world has sort of gravitated to movement, you know, emotional and political movements and cultural movements by spectacle. Who can be the most spectacular and get people's attentions and this and that? And this is what we live in. This is the climate we live in. And, you know, this is kind of, you know, putting a stop to that. And, okay, we're going to have a trial, and we're not going to play these games in this trial. We're going to go by the law. You know?
Well, Trey Gowdy, who does the
right.
night show on Fox News, Trey Gowdy, who used
right.
to be in government himself, I think, I don't know if he was the House or a senator in the Senate.
He was a congressman, yeah, he was a congressman.
Yeah. Well, he's now got his own show on Fox, of course,
mm-hmm.
and he and this assistant, former assistant U.S. Attorney,
mm-hmm.
While on the build up to this big nothing burger, which is what I consider it, they were comparing it to the trial of Aaron Burr. For many of you who forget or don't know, he's the guy who killed Alexander Hamilton, and
right.
Aaron Burr was vice president at that time and killed him in a duel, and they're comparing it to them, and then I thought, that's ridiculous. Okay, that's totally, you know, this is like a.
Well, why don't they compare it to the assassination of Abraham Lincoln? Well, I mean, go early
well,
to the top.
I mean,
damn, man.
Because this
Shit.
Is Burr. Well, I mean, at least Lincoln was a Republican. You're right. But I mean, the thing they're comparing to Burr, and I thought, oh, they're surely not doing this because Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, the musical. You're talking about
spectacles. A big hit in New York,
very,
by the way. Yeah.
Big hit in New York. And sure enough, right out of their mouths on Fox News, this is it today, just a few minutes ago, said, well, you know, Hamilton, he. And Aaron Burr, they said, of course, Aaron. And then they took it one step further, John Grant.
Uh-huh.
They claimed that this is, on a philosophical realm, this is tantamount to the trial of Socrates.
Oh, good. Socrates. Oh, my God. Donald Trump compared to Socrates. Wow, that takes some
right.
guts, man. Takes some real
yeah.
guts. Well, Well, Socrates, of course, was given the hemlock and had to kill himself and was, you know, given a death penalty because he was corrupting the youth of Athens. No, I don't know. Is Donald Trump corrupting the youth of America, corrupting us all in this swamp that he said he was going to conquer, but he brought with him, you know? And then,
well, the only way this could be topped is if they say that he is now on the cross of Calgary, and he is like Jesus Christ. They've already called him.
Exactly. Right. Well, they already have a, you know, a lot of the fundamentalists have given him a break on all his whoring and all his crimes and moral crimes, you know, because, well, you know, he likes us. He likes fundamental Christians, and he works for us, so we don't care if he's a, you know, bum. We don't care if he hangs out with prostitutes and porn stars and all that, you know.
Wants to grab my wife's pussy.
Yeah, let go of my wife's pussy. Yeah, come on.
Come on, just give it. Give him Darius, Cyrus, Jesus Christ. Take your pick among these
Hocus-pocus
people. The Hocus-pocus people, you know, they got it. But, yeah, honestly,
you could also go, you know, since Hitler is, you know, revered by a lot of his base, you could also say, you know, he's, you know, he could end like Hitler, too. You know, Hitler ran out of gas, you know, and it kind of all fell apart for him there at the very end. And, you know, there's metaphors all over history, you know. It's
But Trey Gowdy on Fox News today compared first to Aaron Burr, and then I figured he probably realized that most people don't know who Aaron Burr is in America.
Right.
And then he clarified, well, that's the guy that killed Hamilton. And Hamilton was very popular. And he said, just like you did.
In New York. And it was probably good that he killed Hamilton.
Hamilton's out of New York. And then, to top it off, this assistant attorney general, former, said, well, it's more like Socrates. And I was like, going, oh, I got to tell John this. This is it. I mean, Socrates, my God, the guy that used dialectics to teach his students dialectics. But, Donald Trump has taught people only one thing, him.
Right.
And
the Donald Trump dialectic.
non-dialectic. And Fox,
it's like an onanistic dialectic, you know, only yourself.
Yeah.
You know.
And, I mean, I get on the free-to-watch TV, and it's everywhere. Reuters had a live cam outside the courthouse. The Washington Post, Democracy Dies in Darkness. They're outside the courthouse. So there is nothing. I think they're coming out. They're coming out now. Some of them are outside the courtroom.
I don't know. I just see the cops standing around trying to figure out what's going on here.
Well,
and in a minute, I think something's going to happen, and then all of a sudden everybody will be energized here. I don't know. What is Donald Trump's code name? You know, like Bill Clinton was Elvis is in the building, you know.
Oh, I do know that.
What is Trump's...
Well,
here comes the people. And now, who are these people?
Yeah. There's Don coming out of the courtroom.
Oh, I don't see him.
Right there.
Do you see him?
Yeah, it's on CBS. CBS has a live feed down the hallway.
Let me try.
No, he just turned his left.
I'm
screen right, and he's moving. I just feel like he'll reappear like a jack-in-the-box, believe me. He'll come out in his clown suit. And,
I mean, this is a comedy. You got to tell you. Wow.
It's like just a little bit above a DUI. I mean, here he is.
Okay, here he comes. Here he is.
All right.
There's the man with his red tie. He doesn't look very happy. No, he's very scowling. Here he comes. Well, he's going to get fingerprinted, I guess. I don't know. Well, that was the only shot we got of him here. Mike, you there? Hello?
Yeah. Sorry.
I didn't know if you fell off somewhere.
I was laughing so fucking hard I could hardly keep myself. Now it's on a loop. This is the orange baboon emerges from the courtroom. And he's grimacing.
Yeah. Yeah,
he eyeballed the camera in the hallway. Now
he did. He gave us a little dismissive stare.
Yeah.
Like,
I've got the world looking at me now.
Right.
And it's not even as bad as a DUI. I'm walking through this. I got all these cops, these overweight cops here, I've got the world by the short hair. I mean, this is what he wants.
That's what he wants you to think, right?
It is. I mean, just look at CBS. Look at all the.
Well, the point, ABC. Yes, but the point
what
is.
What do you want to bet?
ABC's
covering it today. Go ahead.
Who?
I'm listening.
Well,
ABC,
no, I mean, the idea he's in control, I know we love that, we laugh, but the point of this whole exercise, this spectacle, as I call it this morning, is that he does not have it by the short hairs. In other words, in this courtroom and all of the backup and all of the research and all of the investigations they've done and they've set their ducks up, in this courtroom where this narrative will be played out, one narrative versus another, which is a trial for a jury, and he doesn't have control. That's the point. He has to be fingerprinted. He has to. I don't know whether they were going to photograph him. You know, that was the big issue. I think they're doing a reverse English. They're saying, oh, yeah, we want a photograph, please. You know, we'll use it and we'll pump it up and all this, and hoping that maybe that'll scare them and they won't take a photograph, we'll have a mugshot. There's all sorts of spin going on here, Oh, yeah, I want cameras in the courtroom, please, the cameras in the courtroom. And then he goes into the courtroom and he says, no way do I want cameras in here, it is a comedy. I mean, it's a total unfolding real-life drama. I mean, this is a reality TV star. I watched the second of the last season, the second of Succession last night, HBO, which is the most ruthless show ever done about this family and trying this. It's like the Murdoch family, a fictional Murdoch family with Fox News. And they're so ruthless, it's a drama. They're playing out a drama because these people in Succession have so much money that they can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And you have people like Donald Trump that has so much money, and he's created this persona of himself that's above the law. Here he comes again. It's the same picture, I think. But he's still scowling.
The loop of him scowling coming out of the courtroom is on a loop here. It's just like you get to see him scowling 20 times.
Right. They just threw the camera.
Although I do think the still photographers, your Jermaine,
they were throwing him out.
Came out just a few, they just threw him out. ABC has Chris Christie sitting in front of a New Jersey state attorney seal on ABC, and Chris Christie's now a expert commentator. So we got this guy, a revolving door bureaucrat, corrupt New Jersey, and then we have Trey Gowdy on Fox News, who has his own show. All these guys, why aren't we getting these bloated idiots and Trey Gowdy? Why are these networks giving these people money? And they're sitting there. This is ABC. I mean, all three main networks in the United States are carrying this empty hallway, overweight bored cops. This is and the outside. Even if there are pro-Trump people outside behind the bike racks. A lot of bike racks are these, it seems, very civilized, peaceful people standing around, waiting for what? To see the orange bedroom.
Well, they're waiting for the spectacle. That's what I'm trying to say.
There is
you know, The Society of the Spectacle by Guy Debord in 1967, a fundamental book of radical politics, you know. The guy ended up committing suicide in 1994, but
well, that's a
very interesting character. The spectacle. Here, I could read some of this, you know. It's a pretty amazing.
God, no.
If
you're going to try or Aaron Burr.
The continued unfolding of our epoch has merely confirmed and further illustrated the theory of the spectacle.
Well, this is one of the most meaningless spectacles, wasting valuable air news time on the three major networks in the United States. I was sitting here going, they're treating this like this is 1963 Dallas. Is it possible?
Well, but Mike,
is it possible that there's an Oswald coming out of the New York gutter?
Oh, you're good. You're good. That was a major spectacle moment.
And a goddamn, and it went all over the world within minutes. You know, Oswald emerges out. Jack Ruby shoots.
Jack Ruby. Well, you're doing what Barbara Walters did on the commentary of the O.J. Simpson Bronco. I remember I watched that for about an hour, and and I remember Barbara Walters was there, and she was talking to one of the news heads, and she said, "Oh my God, what if it's the what ifs like you were doing here." What if they put O.J. in the cell next to the Menendez brothers? And Peter Jennings basically shut her up. Oh, Barbara, goddamn, you know, like, and, you know, she was trying to bring in all these, you know, these big story spectacle ideas of, oh, my God, O.J. in the cell next to the Menendez brothers, of course, who had shotgunned their parents, you know, in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was to me, this is a big, big show, a spectacle for one simple reason. The untouchable ex-president of the United States has now been touched. He is being fondled pretty significantly here. The untouchable is now being touched. That's a big story.
You talked about earlier, the big story is MTG. Saying she's going to come up there, MTG inciting a riot or something in her mind.
Right.
New York. But here's the clincher. You may be right about the spectacle to come, because if Georgia has anything other than peaches, they will indict the orange baboon and bring him down there.
Oh.
Now that will be a spectacle.
Fannie Willis, another black prosecutor is going to nail the son of a bitch. Yeah.
Well, those are much more serious crimes than this crap.
Yeah.
This book.
Right. We have the evidence
problem.
On TV. We've seen it 150 times. You know.
Right.
All I need is 11,700 votes. Find them. I don't care where you find them. You know. Make them up.
Now take my word for it. Georgia will be mobbed by Trump-lodites, and the Trump-lodites will be surrounding the courthouse to protect Donnie. And it's safe territory.
Oh, yeah.
It's safe territory in Georgia.
Exactly.
So
it's a different story in Georgia. Absolutely.
Yeah right. So I mean, I don't even think they have $200 million to put that to protect the
country. I think that's when they call out the National Guard, but of course they have a Republican governor there,
I can't keep track of Georgia. It's hard to do.
Yeah, Georgia of course has a
I mean, is that the order of battle, and then after that it's DC with this guy Jack Smith.
Jack Smith
prosecutor.
Has two cases. Yeah, he has the Mar-a-Lago case, and he has the he's coming out with different people now. He's coming out again. He's walking around. Okay, there he goes.
They're releasing a still photograph.
Well, you know, to me, here's a picture. Here's a still picture of him. It's bad aspect. You know, he's sitting at a table with all his lawyers. His hair looks great.
He would have that ugly of a woman next to him. It's a very ugly.
You have much choice in that situation, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, there was another one, more of his style, that was on earlier yesterday. I don't know. I can't remember.
Right.
But she's not there. This one is sort of a.
Well, he looks very unhappy, but as I say, his hair is great. You know, his hair engineer is really
happy.
His hair engineer has really worked a bouffant out. It's very nice. Yeah.
He does not look unhappy. Now, when he came out of the courtroom, he staged his scowl, but he's not.
But you know, all of this.
He knows.
And I must confess, that this is, in my case, certainly an element of Schadenfreude, which is, you know, like soft sadism. And, you know, I think sadism plays a big part in this. I've talked about this before. You know, the idea of, you know, make liberals cry again. God, I feel so good when I make these bastards cry, you know. And so, you know, we're all feeling a certain Schadenfreude to see Donald, you know, in the docket, as we call it, you know. This is good, and we're all enjoying it, and we're all enjoying Donald's misfortune of being there, you know.
I want some serious orange pajamas put on this son of a bitch, and until then.
Match his hair,
It's just your spectacle to call it, use your
spectacle.
It's spectacle.
Guy DeBoer, who was a radical.
And all these.
And he was a wild man in France. Of course, the riots in 1968, he pumped those up. And Society of the Spectacle is a book that was way ahead of its time. And with the rise of the internet and social media, what he's saying is in truth in spades. It's amazing. And of course, Donald Trump knows it. And Steve Bannon. You know him, right?
I have
no doubt in my mind that Steve Bannon has not read Guy Debord's The Society of the Spectacle. I imagine he has read it 6 times and underlined it and all this kind of stuff. Because Donald Trump, the way he behaves, he understands this idea of a society, you know, which is moved, politically and culturally moved by the spectacle, by spectacular things, you know. And
over a piece of shit.
Over a piece of shit. I mean, that's his mind. He thinks.
He's got 3 mainstream news networks live staring at the equivalent of a, like I said, a traffic court, a DUI. It's just some stupid little fucking charges. He'll never see.
Campaign financing violations. I mean,
why he's doing?
People go to jail for that.
Why he's worried about? Well, he's not even worried about it. He's just that was like what would that be? 9 years ago. 9 years ago. Now he's making $1 million. He probably $1.5 million off Waco, Texas, of all places.
Right.
I mean, he's probably making $1 million now. This is an escalating snowball.
Well, this is what
him.
I'm saying.
Money.
The man understands the spectacle versus the rule of law and politics, you know, and all that. The guy instinctually understands Guy Debord's idea of the society of the spectacle.
He knows. Look, here's the deal. His supporters are going around these dumb, stupid, globalist, coastal elite, Soros bags. You know, they don't even realize, I'm going to send Donnie another $25, you know? He is so goddamn genius that he doesn't even have to read that French guy's fucking book.
He doesn't. You're right. He understands it implicitly, instinctually, absolutely.
Mail him another fucking $25, you know? I mean, and he's making out like a thief, you know?
Yeah, and I would suggest in the idea of the Society of the Spectacle, this guy, Donald J. Trump, is driving the rise of the spectacle like no one else. You know, I mean, this guy, you know, he just lives it. It's the way he operates. He does not respect the rule of law, obviously. Politics, he'll do anything he wants. He's, you know, that's the trouble. They're afraid of him testifying at his own trial because he'll hang himself and create more crimes. You know? They just can't control the guy. You know?
Well, here's the operating theme among all these people. Even if he is convicted of a felony,
right.
Okay?
Right.
He's not going to go to jail. He could
probably
be
not.
President.
No.
He could be a president even in right. jail if he's elected, and that's only a year.
Well,
away.
I don't know. You know, who knows about these things? Because there are those other three cases that are more serious than this one. You know, I mean, especially one of the cases is about January 6th. I mean, if that's not a serious case, I don't know what is. You know, so. So they're building on it. This is the first one. And I, you know, as someone pointed out, I forget when it was, who it was, that, you know, like Watergate, Iran-Contra, you know, every of these scandals have their names, right? Well, this scandal is going to be dubbed the Stormy Daniels scandal somehow. You know, Stormy Daniels' name is going to go down in history for this. And Stormy Daniels, in fact, is very savvy of this. She insists, and they've said this, you know, that Lawrence O'Donnell says, I always called her, you know, whatever, Christopher, whatever her name is. And Stormy Daniels made it be known, I don't want to be known by my real name. When you talk about me, I want to be called Stormy Daniels.
Well, sure. She's got a label.
And, of course, you know, it's like the guy's branded, was basically taken down, the beginning of his takedown is my argument, by a porn star named Stormy Daniels. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. You know what I mean? Stormy Daniels. Turned out to be quite a storm for him there, you know?
Yeah, well,
we'll
who
see.
Was it? Well, she is just the... a low rent version of God. I've tried. See, I have forgot her name.
Blaze Star, you mean?
The woman that went down on Bill Clinton in the Oval Office.
Oh, well, Lewinsky. Yeah,
Monica Lewinsky.
Lewinsky. Lewinsky wasn't a professional. She was a 22-year-old intern. You know,
well, she's doing it better. I mean, Stormy's doing it better.
Well, of course. Well, Stormy's a pro. That's
she's
what I'm saying. Stormy
yeah,
is
a
pro.
We got Donald.
And, of course, what's his name? One of these guys on MSNBC, he was arguing with somebody that called Stormy Daniels a prostitute. No. Stormy Daniels is a porn star. There's a difference.
Worker.
A sex worker, but a porn star is different than a prostitute. Let's get our semantics correct here. Come on.
They're both Well, it's like pronouns. I just sort of like, what's more accurate?
It's like pronouns.
Right. But I think right now Mushroom Dick is getting upstaged by Stormy Daniels. And she calls him Mushroom Dick, all right? So, I mean.
Did she? Oh, my God. There you go. That'll live in infamy. That'll go down.
That's what she calls him, okay? And Michael Cohen calls him the orange, what was it, Mandarin, the orange something Mandarin.
Oh,
and
right,
and Liz
right.
Cheney claims, Liz Cheney
uh-huh.
claims
uh-huh.
that on January, the evening of January 6th,
uh-huh.
other Republicans called him the orange Jesus.
Oh,
so, I mean, other, yes, Liz Cheney, that's from a rhino. Liz Cheney.
Right.
So the word salad is getting outrageous. But and I can't imagine. I mean, you know, they hear Terry Gowdy on Fox News is comparing. Well, even if he's convicted, look at Eugene Debs. Now, I mean, that's
right,
to me that's like I mean, you know, to me that's sacrilege to my socialist background.
Well,
you know, I'm like going, they're comparing him first to Aaron Burr, then Socrates, now Eugene Debs.
Oh, boy. And just the Socrates analogy really takes me out. Well, apparently he has told the judge, I plead not guilty.
Of course. Why wouldn't he?
Well, you know. Well, I'm looking at his still picture here with all his lawyers and stuff, and he's looking, you know, he's looking at the camera, and I'm thinking, like, what is going on in this man's mind as he's sitting there humiliated?
Not humiliated. He's not humiliated.
He is humiliated. In his mind, he's humiliated because he can't do anything.
No, he's telling people he's humiliated. That he's not. He is.
Okay, fair enough. But my point is, what's going on in his head? He is thinking revenge. I am going to get my revenge on these people who are trying to humiliate me here. You know.
I'll take care of them later. This guy doesn't need to read a crazy French socialist or whatever the French guy was.
Guy Debord, the Society of the Spectacle.
Well, he knows the spectacle because Donnie's been working with spectacle since he lost to Taj Mahal in Atlanta, went bankrupt practically. And then made a comeback with a goddamn stupid TV show. But I never watched it. I mean, I had enough people.
Oh, I didn't. I think I watched 5 minutes of it for, you know, just being cultural.
It only ended up with somebody, with Big Donnie, Mushroom Dick, firing somebody. And I thought, why do I want to watch it?
Well, of course.
In my life.
The ultimate power is to fire somebody, you know, and you're this is the test of a real manager, you know, the ability to fire people, you know, and to do it ruthlessly, you know, and even to take a certain joy in it at times, you know.
Oh, the audience that watches that, they did.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
And you know, he's showing off his power, his ruthlessness, his cruelty. You know, as the guy here wrote a book, Adam Serwer, The Cruelty is the Point. You know, no authoritarians have to be cruel. They have to be ruthless and cruel in order to pull it off. I could never do that. I was known, somebody once told me when I was president of Vets for Peace chapter, that publicly told everyone, John Grant is the most reluctant leader I've ever seen in my life. And he was right. You know, he was right. I'm a writer. I'm not a leader, but, you know, because I'm too soft. I'm too nice a guy, you know. I wouldn't slash somebody's throat because they were in my way, you know.
Well, the people the people out here eat this shit up.
I know.
All three news medias. I mean, this is as the world turns soap opera time, and instead they're going, yeah, Mom, shut up. We're going to watch Donnie. He's like a clueless, a rich kid. You know, he's just sitting around going, all this attention about me. All this about me. And I think that's genius to get the attention. You know, I think a lot of his base are going to eat this up. And I really do think that as this accelerates, the problem will be him containing the MTGs and the nuts in his group, in his base. Mm-hmm. So-called base.
Right.
I think the enthusiasm of his triumph of the will going down to Georgia.
Good reference.
He won't be able to contain him. You know, and he'll have to figure out ways that they can, you know, do things without homicidal intentions. You know, so mm-hmm. I, I think it's a serious thing. It's serious in that because I think we'll have these same stupid news media giving all that attention to him each step of the way. Well,
attention. Attention is the goal of everything in the spectacle. How do you get attention? How do you bitch slap the audience out there so they're paying attention to you? You know, and as we understand, you know, it's the oldest thing in the world, you know, with publicity. You know, just so you mention my name, I don't care what you say, you spell it right, you know. And of course, nowadays, they even factor in very sophisticated stuff of how to make progress or how to make hay with your power when people hate you. You know, that there's value in people hating you, you know, that that can be turned into a profit. You know, it's very, very spooky these days when people try to, you know, try to get ahead of the spectacle and then try to get in there and get attention. And, you know, it's a totally corrupt operation. But, you know, there's no way out. We're in it because of the Internet. Thanks a lot, you know.
Well, we hear over and over from the Trump supporters that this judge, or no, excuse me, the prosecutor received over $1 million in George Soros money to donate to Bragg's campaign.
Uh-huh.
And I've checked it, and they're right. I mean, this is what bothers me.
So what?
Let me tell you, so what? Why
okay.
is it ABC and CBS detailing the millions of dollars that were given by another billionaire to support Donald Trump?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like back and forth. David K. Johnson was on Democracy
mm-hmm.
Now! This morning.
Sure.
And he gave a very eloquent takedown of Donald Trump The fact news media is failing miserably, you know. The only thing I see creeping out of this whole thing is that the same judge that Donald Trump is appearing for today is the same judge that's going to do Steve Bannon. Okay, and I think that's
well, it did Weissenberg already. Right.
Yeah, I mean this judge is—he's on fire. He's pursuing something I think well worth noting. I don't even know the name of the judge, but I'll learn it.
Meerschaum, something like that. Yeah, Meerschaum.
Meerschaum is the name of the pipe that I know of. This is a problem when we deal with Donald Trump because the spectacle. The brightness of orange is so bright that people, they lose the glow overshadows any facts.
Right.
Facts about
well, you know, corruption. Truth is boring. You know, orange-haired Donald is not boring. You know, that's why he gets attention because he's not boring. You know, the law is boring, but hey. Unfortunately, he hooked up and pissed off the law in the capital of Blue State America, New York City, the Big Apple, which spawned the gentleman himself, you know, and it circled around and going to bite him in the ass here,
Well, let's see how it goes. Right now, it's going to take over a year. He'll be president by the time this is over with.
Wow, that's a good one.
John Grant.
All right, Mike. Well, what's the spectacle?